The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I think we've got a pretty standard Q&A show set to go for you today. Start with a question or two on Social Security, and then a variety of topics, whatever kind of attracts Jim's attention in his email box. That said, the reason why he's looking through his email is that is how to submit your own questions for the show for our consideration, and that email address you'd send those questions to if you want us to attempt to answer them on the show here is jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. In the subject line, indicate that it's a question for the podcast, and it's also good to put a word or two about the subject in that subject line, the topic that you're interested in, just when he's searching through things, that's helps him categorize things in his filing system, I guess you might say. So yeah, that's pretty much it. Don't have much else going on. I'm getting ready to go back to a new semester at teaching at school. For those of you who don't know, I teach at Colorado State University in the finance department. I teach a combination of both traditional finance and financial planning courses, and I'm the director of the financial planning program there at Colorado State University. And classes start in about 10 days or so from when we are recording this. So there's always a flurry of activity and meetings and that sort of thing before the semester starts each fall. So it's always exciting to see a new batch of kids. I can call them kids. I'm old enough at this point. They seem younger and younger every year, even though they're all the same age when they come in. But I know that that's me just getting older and older. So anyway. Jim's back in Colorado. He was supposed to bring me some harvest from his garden yesterday, and I didn't see anything. So hopefully it's not picked and sitting in a hot car somewhere. Maybe Jim can enlighten me as to the status of my requested
produce. You just had to throw me under the boat on this one, because you bought my birthday gift yesterday and I forgot your veggies. That's what you're doing. You're looking for sympathy from our listeners.
No, I didn't. I don't think I understand. You mentioned bring them again, but I don't know if that meant they're still attached to their vines growing.
No, they're picked. Oh. Because you requested, if memory serves me correct, you wanted onions, right?
Yellow and white onions and zucchini, I
think. Okay, the onions were picked a week or so ago because you cure them for 4 days. And I do it 3 to 4 days in the sun. And then you bring them in, just like in a grocery store. So your onions were already picked. They're cured, meaning that's gives them the one or two layers of dead skin that hardens around the outside of the onion. Mm-hmm. You do that by pulling the bulbs off. The onion bulbs grow above the ground. Everybody thinks they grow under the ground. They don't. So you just rip it out, cut the roots, cut the top, and let it sit out in the sun, which we have ample. Yeah. Sun this week.
Probably only needed a couple hours to crust up.
Oh my God, is it so freaking hot this week? But no, so your onions, I'm looking at what you requested. Actually, I can't find what you requested. There we go. What color onions did you want? White onions, yellow onions, no problem. The leeks are still in the ground. I'm not going to give you the ones that I already harvested. They're still in the ground. Okay. And the zucchini could be stuff that I've already harvested or not. You know, zucchini, if I don't harvest it at the right size, it like grows a foot overnight.
Yeah.
So you're all set. Okay. You'll get it.
Okay.
Perfect. So quit your bitching, as they say.
No. I was just trying to clarify when it might show up.
Also, do you want cucumbers? I didn't see you put any request in for beets or cucumbers.
I was surprised by that as well. But I asked my wife, and I guess she has plenty of beets and plenty of cucumbers. So
okay,
they weren't on the list. You're right.
I was surprised because I have tasty cucumbers mm-hmm. and scrumptious beets.
Are they kind of English low seeds, or are they regular?
I have, which are very, very similar to an English cucumber, but they grow more curved and weirdish looking. I have Armenian striped cucumbers and Diva cucumbers, which are more of a traditional cucumber that you would get in a store.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If she changes her mind, I'll let you know.
Excellent. Other than that, you will get white onions, yellow onions, leeks, and zucchini. I did also notice no red onions, so I'm guessing you guys are not big salad eaters.
We do a fair amount of salads, but I think we have a plethora of red onions right now.
Gotcha.
It was more of a
because you grow them, or you just go to the store thing. And buy 15 of them at a time.
We don't have any red onions growing this year, so we just have a bag of them.
Gotcha. All right. Well, let's move on before people start complaining, because you do this all the time. You banter, you go down your love of gardening, and you don't shut up
and
about it.
And the weather and Ohio.
Weather and the dryness and how you might relocate in the future, and just people get all ticked off that you do that. Okay, let's get deeper in. This is Jim. That was Chris, I won't even say sidekick. That would be demeaning his importance at the firm. My cohort, if you will. Chris, we host the Retirement and IRA Show, and this is the EDU. No, it is not the EDU. It is the Q&A version, where you send questions, we provide answers. Can't say how accurate our answers are, but we will definitely provide one. As always, you should do your
own
best. Proofing.
Yeah, we do our best.
We do our best.
Perfect. Yeah.
But you should do your own proofing. Mm-hmm. As you dive deeper into topics and make your own decision. We can provide what we think is the correct answer, but we're only human and we could also be wrong. Okay. So let's get into Social Security questions, if you will. We put out a call for more Social Security questions, and lo and behold, we did get a few in. So keep sending your Social Security questions. Per Chris's request, and he's right, we probably won't be answering many on disability unless it ties into retirement planning. Unfortunately, we are not experts in the disability aspect of Social Security, and the claiming strategies can be quite convoluted, and you're going to be denied. That's just the way the game works. And then you hire an attorney, and the attorney fights for you, and about two and a half years later, Social Security will give it to you in a lump sum check, and it's silly how that works, Chris. It's ridiculous. But we see it constantly operating that way.
I'm not as offended by the kind of high bar for being approved immediately and then having to appeal it.
But they always give in. Have you ever seen anyone denied?
Oh, yeah.
You have?
Oh, yeah. And that process, what bothers me is the 2 to 2.5 years to finally get your final answer. That part is ridiculous. But it is, it's a capacity issue. So
I agree they have to be stern because people will game the system. Right. And I'm sure people are gaming the system. But everyone that we work with has always been approved. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, we don't hear about the people who weren't. So.
Oh, okay. I only hear about the ones that were. Okay, right,
exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Well, it seems the ones that we always talk to me about, they've been approved.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So anyways, let's get into a couple Social Security questions, and then we've got some annuity questions and whatever else I pick. I will confess, folks, I right now do not have the questions that I'm going to answer. I've been doing a ton of other things today. Today is Friday the 14th. No, it's not. It's Thursday the 14th. And yours truly has a very busy day. I don't know why, but it was. So as we go, these questions will be new to me as well. So this will be an interesting show, I'm sure. All righty, let me find some Social Security questions that I might want to get to. I have to do a search. You know, I'm using the new Outlook. Have you switched to the new Outlook from the old Outlook?
No. I tried it when it first came out. I switched back because it doesn't do a few of the things that I do.
It's buggy. It's annoying.
Yeah, no, I'm not a fan. Other people who don't use the things that I'm offended by or bothered by will probably love it, but doesn't work.
I'm trying to get used to it because Microsoft announced that it's supposed to come out in September, which means it'll probably come out next June. But anyways, they're supposed to be integrating Copilot, their ChatGPT, if you will, deeply into Outlook, because I have thousands of emails and all in different folders. And sometimes I'm intuitively looking for the structure of an email. I know someone mentioned this. Can you find it? And the search feature doesn't let me do that. So I asked Copilot a couple of days ago, hey, you know, can you do that? And it says, well, not right now, but, and it then showed me what Microsoft announced. And it's supposed to deeply integrate, but only with the new Outlook, not the old Outlook.
That's a little weird because I'm running the old Outlook and I've got a Copilot assistant embedded in it.
Yeah, but it cannot read because I asked it. I said, I want you to search all my emails
and
find the ones.
Task.
And it can't. It cannot do that. That level that I want is going to be available later. But according to Copilot, it's only going to be available in the new Outlook, not the old Outlook.
Yeah. Well, I know it. At some point, it'll just be the new. They'll give up on the old. But I think they're trying to figure out how many of the features from the old they thought people didn't use, but they do that they want to put in the new one. But at some point, we'll get cut off on the old one, I'm sure.
Well, I'll tell you what's annoying in the new one, and I don't know if they changed it. When they first released it, months and months and months ago, I switched. There's a little toggle. I toggled over. I hated it, and I toggled back until the past week. Now I'm trying to learn it again. It doesn't let you batch print emails. So I wanted to search a bunch of emails. A lot, over almost 100, not quite 100.
Oh, you wanted to print them to a PDF and then search it?
A PDF and then search through them using Copilot or ChatGPT. Because I was looking, I wanted AI to review the emails and say, hey, out of all these emails that I received, which ones, I don't want to get deep into what these emails were, but people writing to us about a certain position we were looking for, you know, which ones in your opinion seem to have the background that I asked for, and then prioritize them in your opinion based on what they wrote. So I can start looking through them in the order of the best match to the least best. And you need AI to do that. You couldn't batch print emails in the new Outlook. Now, maybe they've added that. I haven't tried it since. I had to switch to the old to click the emails I wanted to batch print them. You couldn't do it in the new one. And when I asked Copilot why, it was like, yeah, we can't. We don't know. And so it told me how to complain to Microsoft, go to their website and click a certain area. It showed me how to do all that. So I could say, hey, bring that feature back. So maybe they brought it back. I don't know. But that was just an annoying. Why get rid of that? That was just annoying.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm done complaining.
Okay.
Let's get to our Social Security questions. We have one that came in, Chris. I'm going to forward it to you now. He gave a bunch of attachments. So you're going to get it. Let me send that to you. Oh, wait a minute. Don't read it. Let me see if he has a hint. No, no hints. You can go ahead and look at it.
Okay.
I don't think you're going to need the attachments, but they're there just in case.
Just in case? Okay.
Yes. So he writes, "Hi, Jim, my name is," and we're not going to say what it is. We will call him George. "I have a Social Security question, and I'm hopeful you might be able to shine some light on it. In particular, I am a 70-year-old male, born June 26, 1955. I started taking Social Security 3 months ago. As you can see in my attached Social Security benefit verification letter, my full monthly Social Security benefit before any deductions is $4,600. I'm rounding up, Chris, as you can see, to keep the math simple. Okay. $4,600. Mm-hmm. My spouse is 71 and female. She was born June 14th, 1954. She applied for her spousal benefits. And after a couple of months, she received notification that her full monthly Social Security benefit before any deductions will be $1,800. It's my understanding that a spousal benefit is typically 50% of the primary benefit. I even found the below on the Social Security website. It says how the spousal benefit is determined. Your spouse's benefit could be up to one half of the amount your spouse is eligible to receive at their full retirement age. I'm going to stop reading there, Chris, because that sentence says it all. I'm sure you know where I'm going with this. I'm not going to post the rest. People can find it on their website. There being Social Security's website. The gentleman continues, "Obviously, my spouse's monthly benefit is significantly less than the 50% of my benefit. If it comes into play, my spouse's career was primarily in education, and she does receive a State Teachers Retirement System of Ohio." Ooh, shout out to Ohio, where I may move to, folks. That's why. "Ohio monthly gross benefit of $2,400. Could you or your colleague please provide some insight as to why my spouse's benefit is significantly less than half of my benefit?"
Yep, I can clear it right up. And those numbers look to be correct based on what you have told me. And that is from the snippet that he provided. His answer is actually right in what he copy and pasted. He just doesn't understand the Social Security terminology. That's the disconnect. That statement that you read, Jim, I'll read it again. "Your full spouse's benefit could be up to one half of the amount your spouse is eligible to receive at their full retirement age." And full retirement age, as you can see, but I'm going to describe to our listeners, as in bold. That's the key. They're trying to emphasize that. Age 70, you know, he turned it on a couple months before age 70 based on the description, but he was basically age 70 when he turned it on. Age 70 is not his full retirement age. His full retirement age was 66 and 2 months if he was born in 1955. So his benefit, if he had claimed then, is the basis for the spousal benefit. And if doing a little quick math as Jim was talking here, looks like the number's right in line with that, that his full retirement age benefit was right around $3,600 a month, which means his wife gets $1,800, 50% of that. Her having an education background, a career as a teacher, none of that matters anymore. For those people that were affected by the GPO and WEP provisions, which could happen for government workers, in particular teachers around the country, that provision has been gone now since the beginning of this year. And so the WEP and GPO were repealed, so we don't have to worry about, you know, teachers' pensions and that sort of thing affecting your Social Security benefit. Changes could come in the future bringing some of those provisions back, but right now we don't have to worry about it. So that's what's going on here. As you earn delayed retirement credits, as he did, by waiting past your full retirement age to collect, it helps in two scenarios. It helps you while you're alive because it makes your retirement benefit that you're receiving bigger. It helps your surviving spouse because your bigger benefit that you achieved by having delayed retirement credits will go to them when you have passed away, assuming their benefit isn't bigger, and it's not in this case. So your wife will benefit, you having, you know, you're both benefiting now because you have about a 23% higher benefit than you otherwise would have, or 25% roughly, benefit than had he claimed his full retirement age. The surviving spouse, whichever the two of them it is, will still retain that higher benefit. So the delayed retirement credits helped there. What it doesn't help is the spousal benefit that your spouse receives while you're alive, because that does not increase with delayed retirement credits. It is maxed out, and it says up to one half of the amount of technically your PIA, primary insurance amount, which is just another name for your full retirement age retirement benefit. So you have to basically do some math to figure out what your benefit would have been back at 66 and 2 months. She gets half of that. So there's no reason to go talk to Social Security. Looks like your numbers are correct, and that's what's going on here. So hopefully that clarified things for this particular, you know, emailer, and also for everybody else out there. Just remember, delaying won't increase the spousal. Does increase your own, and does increase the potential survivor benefit that your spouse might receive, but does not increase the spousal benefit. That's the way to remember it.
Okay, perfect. All righty. I actually found an IRMA question as I was looking for questions to answer, or a Social Security question. I'm going to throw both at you. Which one do you want next?
Hopefully not all at once. Let's finish up the Social Security first, probably.
All right. Oh, this one was unique. He's having trouble with Maximize My Social Security. And I thought, Chris knows how to use that program. Maybe Chris can help.
I do.
So it says, hi, Jim, Chris, Jake, and Jake. Mm-hmm. Chris and the Jakes. Is that what we're calling them, Chris and the Jakes?
Yeah, I should probably, if it's talking about Maximize My Social Security, you should probably throw Keely in here too, because she kind of interacts with that more than anybody in the office as part of the planning process that we have here. But we'll explain what that is in a moment.
Okay. You, meaning you recommended Maximize My Social Security in the past, but I'm not sure it's working correctly. Either that, or Chris made a mistake on two recent podcasts, which wouldn't surprise me because he's constantly making mistakes, unlike Jim, who is really good and smart and knows what he's talking about. Well, thank you, listener. That was so nice of him to say that.
I'm sure it was written just like that.
It was, word for word, just like that. First off, my state hint.
Well, before, let's clarify what they're talking about with Maximize My Social Security. That's a website put out there to help you calculate your Social Security benefit under any number of scenarios that you might throw at it. Allows you to upload your input, your own earnings record, your ages, your, you know, potential pensions you might have, actually not anymore since GPO is gone and WEP is gone. But when it was in effect, it would factor those in. It handles, unlike most of the tools like this out there, it'll handle strange scenarios sometimes. Sometimes people have child and care benefits or things like that, which aren't as typical. So a lot of the tools out there don't handle that. Theirs does. So it's a website that it does cost some money, but it's actually fairly reasonable. I haven't checked it recently. We use the advisor version of it, which is reasonably priced. And then you, as an individual, can go there and play around with it. So that's what he's talking about when he says we've recommended Maximize My Social Security in the past. We recommend it basically because we're familiar with it and we've come to trust it. So I'll be interested to see what he says when he says either they're wrong or I'm wrong. I'm guessing if it comes down to me disagreeing with them, then I'm wrong. Be honest with you. They have proven to be extremely accurate with their, calculations and interpretation of Social Security, benefit rules. So we'll see where this goes.
Alrighty. First off, his hint, and I got the state wrong. I'll say I guessed New Jersey. I thought for sure it was in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. A But he says in 1901, Connecticut was the first state to enact a speed limit. Oh, I just gave the answer away.
I was going to say, is that a true-false question? Or?
You know what I was doing? I was typing at the same time into chat because I wanted to know what the speed limit was. What do you think? So that would be the new question. So Connecticut was the state. I'm curious what the speed limit was, you think, in 1901. And how the hell did Connecticut even enforce it? Because they didn't have radar. But I digress. His hint was, what state in 1901 enacted a speed limit? I guessed New Jersey was Connecticut. Okay. So let's take this to another level. What do you think it was? I'm putting it into ChatGPT now.
I bet it was like 40 or something. And I'm sure they measured it the old-fashioned way, where there were landmarks, and you'd time the car going between those landmarks to determine the speed.
Well, according to chat, you are nowhere close.
Really?
I asked it, Connecticut in 1901 was the first state to enact a speed limit. Mm-hmm. What was that speed limit when it was first enacted? You are right. Connecticut was the first state to enact a motor vehicle speed limit in 1901. It set the speed limit at 12 miles per hour if in a city, 15 out in the countryside. At the time, drivers were also required to slow down when approaching or passing a horse-drawn carriage so they would not frighten the animal, a rule that might have been more important than the speed limit itself back then. Yeah. I will agree, because there'll be far more horses and horse-drawn carriages
15 miles an hour.
Than cars.
Wow. May as well ride a horse.
I think a horse can go 15 miles an hour steadily. Anyways, interesting. See you. Tidbit pieces of information. If Chad is correct, as I've been saying and people have been sharing, it has been incredibly wrong with a lot of things, as we're going to get to on one of the questions shortly. Chat was just hallucinating for sure. Okay.
Did you say you didn't think horses could go 15 miles an hour? Or you
did? At a steady pace for any length of time.
Oh, they could easily do that.
No, not at a steady pace for a reasonable amount of time. It's pretty
not
fast,
for
15
days,
miles an hour.
A horse can easily go 15 miles an hour over a long distance.
I don't know. Yeah. Don't make me go to the chat and start asking it questions.
This is where,
you horse
this
people
is where
out.
Jim
no.
being
no, no,
raised
no, no, no.
in we, Massachusetts talk, comes in versus
you're,
somebody
you're,
raised
you're
in Wyoming.
You're not a horse person. You might have grew up in
Everyone
Dakota, Wyoming.
Everyone in Wyoming knows about horses.
You don't know diddly squat about horses. That hiney of yours hasn't been on a horse. If there's people out there who truly know horses, so I'm talking people in Kentucky or the West, like cowboy
like,
or cowgirl
like where we
like
are.
People. Real people who know horses, can a horse consistently and steadily go 15 miles an hour? That's all I want to know.
Okay, you're going to be inundated with yeses on that, I predict.
We'll see.
So, anyway.
Okay, can we get to the question?
I'm excited to, yes.
Okay, he's got two. My first Social Security question has to do with when I sign up for benefits. I'm 65 and my spouse is 69. My spouse, who is already receiving benefits, will get a top-off when I start collecting mine. In addition, my disabled son, who is already collecting a small SSI benefit and a larger SSDI benefit, will also get additional benefits, and it should all switch to SSDI. My son has been disabled since birth. Since this may be a little bit complicated to do online or even by phone, I was planning on making an appointment at my local Social Security office. My question, do you think I need to bring both my son and wife with me? And what documents should I bring? Or will my wife and son's benefit automatically be adjusted since they are already in Social Security's system?
So based on what's going on here, I would just to be safe, I would take your proof of being married and the birth certificate for your son. That's probably already attached to you and your wife, if he's receiving off of her record. But just to be safe. I think that would be wise. I doubt you need your son with you, but because you're going to be affecting a change to your on your spouse's benefits after you claim, you'd want her with you as well. Probably wouldn't hurt for your son to be there just in case, but I doubt it because I suspect that one or both of you are representative payees for your son. So you're already able to kind of, deal with the benefits that are being paid. So I don't think they're going to ask, just like you wouldn't have to take your 5-year-old child in with you. They're not going to ask the 5-year-old child any questions when you claim a benefit. The birth certificate shows you have a child of a certain age and would receive a benefit on their behalf. So I don't think you'll need to bring him with you, but your wife, I think you probably will if you want to solve it in one visit.
Okay, perfect. Mm-hmm. His second question, which has to do with maximize Social Security.
Okay.
I also bought Maximize My Social Security. Since my spouse is already collecting, it appears that I can get a spousal benefit at 67 while I delay my benefit. But on two recent podcasts, Chris was very specific that this was no longer available to everyone. I believe there's an exception since my son is disabled and my wife and I care for him. Or perhaps I'm not using Maximize My Social Security correctly. But if I remove my son, then the program says I can't get a spousal benefit. Am I doing something wrong? I would appreciate some clarification on this. So would I, Chris. What's going on?
He's caught me on a very narrow carve-out situation, and I will have to admit that my statement that the technique for claiming a spousal and letting your own grow was gone for everyone, I'll have to amend that and add unless, and there I can't think of another exception, but he has caught me in an exception. And that is if you are collecting a child in care benefit. Child in care benefits for people of retirement age in their 60s and 70s are very rare, first of all, because to collect a child in care spousal benefit, which is available to you if you have a spouse that is collecting Social Security and you are caring for the child of that spouse, you can qualify for a spousal benefit without otherwise having to make the normal qualifications for a spousal benefit, for instance, being 62 years old, etc. It's called a child in care spousal benefit, but the child normally has to be under the age of 16. So you can imagine people in their 60s and 70s are not likely to have a child under the age of 16. However, the child in care provision also applies to those with adult disabled children that were disabled while they were a child and remain disabled to this day. So that is where people at their age find it more likely that they might find themselves in a situation like this. And child in care spousal benefits do not fall under the deeming rules, which is what eliminates this strategy for everybody else. Deeming means when you go in to claim a benefit, you are deemed to be claiming your own benefit first and then any other benefits that you might get that would increase it above your own benefit. So you can't go in and say, just give me my spousal now. I'm going to let my own grow in the background. They're going to deem that you are filing for your own benefit at that same time. That's how normal deeming works, and it applies to everybody at every age now. The exception for a while, people were grandfathered in that they didn't necessarily have this deeming rule if they were born before January 2nd of 1954. So that's what led me to my statements on the couple shows he's referencing, that now that people born on January 2nd of 1954 are over the age of 70, there's really no, those who were grandfathered in may have benefited, but now everybody who's left is deemed and couldn't play the game of claiming a spousal only and then switching to their own. what I failed to mention, and I should have. So this was an error on my part of omission, that if it is a child in care benefit, a child in care spousal benefit, you're not affected by deeming. And the reason why this is true is that, you know, child in care usually is for people much younger, in their 40s or 50s or even 30s, that are collecting and otherwise, you know, if they didn't have special rules for child in care, you wouldn't be able to collect a spousal benefit till you're 62 years old. And if even if you did, it would be reduced. So they said, if you're truly caring for a child of a Social Security retirement benefit recipient, we're going to let you claim this without the normal age penalties. And so it was kind of a get out of jail free card for, you know, claiming early a spousal benefit, not only doing that, but also claiming it without being deemed to be claiming your own. So you're not penalized for going after this benefit that was designed to help people caring for young children at home. And as by extension, caring for adult disabled children at home. It's designed as a benefit for those families. And that's what's showing up here. And as you noticed, the reason why my statement was in conflict with what you were seeing on Maximize is Maximize was exactly correct. However, when you were describing it to me, I think it's more available than you said. I believe you said that since your spouse was already collecting, it appears you can get a child in care spousal benefit at 67. You mentioned earlier that you were 65 now. You're eligible for a child in care benefit right now. The only reason maybe Maximize said don't do it now is you told them that you were still earning money. You were still working. So just like any other benefit, the child in care spousal would be affected by the earnings test, which is going to apply to you being only 65 years old. But as long as you're not working and earning too much, you could collect that child in care spousal benefit immediately. So, but maybe it said 67 when you entered it because you told the program you were still working and they knew that the earnings test would wipe it out. So they told you, you know, they said, wait till 67 to do it. You'll likely, and Maximize will calculate this. You'll likely bump up against, not likely, you will bump up against the family maximum issues. So it's not going to maybe increase your benefit, but the numbers you're getting out of Maximize My Social Security will already have factored in the family maximum limits. It handles all that. You can see now why we use Maximize My Social Security ourselves, is it considers all these things that I'm talking about here. And I would say without seeing the report in front of me, what he's describing sounds consistent with the way it should be working. So I'm going to tell you, trust what Maximize is telling you, because it seems to be correct based on your set of facts that you shared with me. And there is that exception to my blanket statement that I've said recently about the death of the file for spousal now, let your own grow in the background, that's eliminated for, I'd call it 99.9% of people, because there's just not that many people in their 60s approaching 70 that have a child in care spousal opportunity. They're out there. There's one right here. And we do hear about them occasionally, but that's not very common. Not very common. So he caught me. So thanks for writing in. I'm glad I was able to take this opportunity to clarify that carve out, just in case there's others out there in a similar situation.
I don't think I've ever heard you talk about that carve out. I'm just amazed that you knew about the carve out. But I certainly didn't know about that carve-out because I was always in the impression as well. It's done. It's closed. That quote-unquote loophole, the government called it a loophole. They wrote it into the law, and then when people used it, they said, oh, that's a loophole.
Right.
And that always made me scratch my head, and I was angry, as I am on a lot of things with the government that they do sometimes when it comes to retirement and Social Security. But for them to create the ability to do the strategy of being able to allow your Social Security to grow and claim on a spouse who's subsequently also claimed. And then when people actually had the audacity to do it, they said, oh, that's a loophole. We're going to close it. We're mad that you're doing what we said you could do. That just always made me scratch my head. But I thought it was over as well, Chris.
Yeah, for just about everybody it is, but there's this exception in the case of a child in care spousal. You don't have to play by the normal deeming rules.
Okay. All righty. Well, with that, folks, let's jump into non-Social Security questions. We're going to get a new question of the week, which came in a couple of days ago. And it's also a cautionary tale, again, about ChatGPT or any AI or any website, podcast, magazine article, blog post. Do your homework. You can get wrong information. Even we make mistakes. So anyways, just a little bit of caution that I want to throw out there. But also, I've received several emails from people who have been having difficulty with chat. And I don't know if they're just using chat or if they're using Perplexity, Gemini, Copilot, chat, all of the large language model out there that you can use. And they're just calling it chat or if they're truly just using ChatGPT. I use it a lot and I'm trying to learn it more and more. But I don't use it for research. I still rely on the Ed Slot group. I rely on my own training, my own knowledge, the collective knowledge of everybody in my office, websites that I truly trust, the IRC code itself. I don't trust it for that yet. But we use AI in the office to help us with note-taking. I used it as I described earlier to quickly scan about 100 emails to prioritize them in the order that I wanted instead of me having to read all 100 and move them into the order I wanted, which for me, I would have printed them because I would have never done that digitally. And I would have literally put them in piles, good, better, best. It did it in seconds for me. So I think AI right now, the low-hanging fruit is content creation and proofing. It's good at editing, grammar correction, whether you use ChatGPT or Grammarly, which is an AI program that I think is the best for grammar. But be cautious if you still use it to ask it a random question like this gentleman did, and for sources. Because it still provided a wrong answer. It's not ready yet for prime time like that. And from what I know from my research, OpenAI and the other large language models, they're really not going after the individual users looking up a simple question like that. They, as Chris rightly pointed out, they're going after higher end reading. If in the medical field, reading x-rays or reading MRI or CT scans, writing code, going after, as Chris rightly pointed out, higher end jobs that were always thought to be immune from technological advances or advances with better improvements to factories and automation in factories. They're not really saying, hey, we're going to create this model that someone can ask a question related to inherited Roth IRAs, and it's going to find the answer. That's not where they're putting their oomph. They're putting their oomph. I asked a physician not too long ago, who would he want reading a x-ray? A computer or a human? And he said, hands down, the computer. But he said, it comes with pros and cons. It finds things that the human eye would have never seen and causes us to have to now talk to our patients about things that really aren't important to us, but we feel we have to now mention that we saw this. But he said he would like, and I'm not speaking for all physicians. If a physician and disagree, that's fine. But he was sharing with me that he would rather have their AI, not chat. They're not uploading it to chat and saying, hey, what do you think of this?
Yeah.
They're using a program that might use OpenAI software behind the scenes, but it has been schooled and trained and proofed to look at x-rays and spot things that a radiologist may not. It's not to replace the radiologist, it's to help them. I'm just sharing what I've been told. And as Chris rightly pointed out, it's going after higher end where we need some deep proofing and some fallback and some ability to use the power of computers that can be taught. Anyways, that's all I have to say. It was not designed for what this guy tried to use it for, at least not right now. And it doesn't surprise me that he got a wrong answer. So here's what he said. Hi, Jim, Chris, Jake, and Jacob. I asked ChatGPT to summarize current IRS rules for inherited Roth IRAs in my specific situation. I'd like you to review what it said for accuracy, because I swear, I remember Chris saying on the podcast that inherited Roth IRAs are not subject to RMDs. I also recall Chris on that same podcast as saying he wouldn't be surprised if things change in the future. That was me saying that part, because I remember this podcast. But I do not recall hearing of any changes yet from you guys. I hope this all makes sense, and hopefully it is an opportunity for Chris to get one up on ChatGPT, since he has stopped competing against it on the state hints. Yes, we did, because Chris was crying like a 12-year-old. Actually, no, it wasn't Chris. It was everybody else who was complaining about it. Yeah. So we took it down. Anyways, I remember that show. Mm-hmm. I shared that I think Congress will change the rules in the future and mandate RMDs from Roths, not only inherited ones, but ones you own. Not because they want to tax them. They're not going to change that. They just don't want them growing. They want revenue. They need revenue. We hit $37 trillion in national debt. I think a week ago or 2 weeks ago. I was appalled when that came across my iPad news feed. $37 trillion. People have no conception how much that is. I do feel taxes will eventually go higher, but I do feel Congress will also find unique ways to generate revenue without increasing taxes. And one way is to tell people while they're alive to start taking RMDs, and when you die under the 10-year rule, to force RMDs, not allow that Roth to sit for another 10 years. And you might be saying, why will Congress want you to take money out of a Roth? Because they're not going to tax it. No. But what will they do afterwards, Chris?
It's going to be outside the Roth and then susceptible to the various taxes that might occur as additional growth happens.
Right. Whether it's growth and you have to now pay capital gains taxes or income taxes on income or non-qualified dividends, or you're going to spend it. And society will benefit by growing, because you're buying things and sales taxes could be generated. And I do feel in the future there'll be a VAT tax, value-added tax. So they'll be getting that benefit. So I do feel that is coming. So I remember talking about that on that podcast in question. But Chris was 100% correct when he said there are no forced RMDs from inherited Roth IRAs, even under Secure 1 and Secure 2. And your chat is just wrong. So he said, here is the summary of my background and what chat told me. I'm going to jump to the bottom of what you copied and pasted from chat, and I hope you saw it and paid attention. Note, this summary is not professional or legal advice. It is based on an AI explanation and may require confirmation against latest IRS guidance. It's a fancy way of saying don't rely on what I'm telling you. So here's what he laid out to chat. My father passed away in 2023 at age 89. I am a non-spouse beneficiary of his Roth IRA. I understand Roth IRAs have no required minimum distributions for the original owner, but have the rules changed for beneficiaries like me? That's what he asked. Uh-huh. Here's what Chat comes back with. Chat says, point one, because my father died after his required beginning date, the IRS interprets the Secure Act to require annual RMDs in years 1 through 9 of the 10-year distribution period, in addition to emptying the account fully by the end of year 10. Let's pause there, because that sentence is correct for traditional IRAs.
Yep.
Not Roth IRAs. You were very clear to Chat. You're talking about Roth IRAs. That first sentence, let me explain what Chat was saying, because Chat is correct in that first sentence if it was talking about traditional IRAs. If you remember when Secure One first passed in 2020, just before COVID, in 2020, it brought back, or it established, not bring back, it established what it called the 10-year rule. And it had been talked about that it was the death of the stretch IRA.
Which and back then, both traditional and Roth IRAs that were inherited by non-spouses, you stretched over your life expectancy based on, the life expectancy tables that were appropriate. So that was the old rule. And, some of that is still cluttering up the internet out there. So that's always something you got to be careful with, that you've got an old article or old reference that's out there. So there were RMDs on Roths. And if you have a Roth that you inherited from those years, your stretching is still continuing, right? You're not subject to this new 10-year rule. So it is possible. I'm bringing this up because I was thinking, boy, there might be a listener out there who's taken RMDs from their Roth, and we're here telling them there's no RMDs from an inherited Roth. Only RMDs from an inherited Roth if you inherited it since 2020, the rules have changed.
The stretch IRA is not dead. It's the Black Knight in Monty Python's In Search of the Holy Grail.
True.
It's gravely wounded, but it's available to certain eligible designated beneficiaries. We won't get into those because we covered those on previous shows deeply. This gentleman is not an eligible designated beneficiary. Y'all should remember, whenever you hear the words, whether they're in a blog, a podcast, a magazine article, a news show, wherever, whatever you may be, or ChatGPT, where you see the words designated beneficiary, just replace them with what, Chris?
Human.
Human. It's so much easier. Mm-hmm. So when I say only eligible designated beneficiaries can stretch, eligible humans. And what are they eligible for, Chris? Stretching.
Oh, yeah.
And a non-eligible designated beneficiary is a non-eligible human. What isn't that human eligible for, Chris?
Stretching.
Stretching. This gentleman is a non-eligible designated beneficiary, and he admits it, and he told that to Chat. Yep. He didn't use it in that language.
Right.
But Chat had that information. But Chat went out and got the information as it applies to traditional IRAs. Because under Secure One and the 10-year rule, everybody thought the 10-year rule would work like the 5-year rule. The 5-year rule, which is still in existence today, it never had gone anywhere, even under the stretch rules, the 5-year rule is still around. And we won't get into the very narrow group of people who are subject to it, but there are a few people subject to it. They have to, as it's always been, they can do nothing irrespective of the age they inherited or the age of the dead guy or their age. If they're subject to the 5-year rule, that IRA has to be closed in 5 years. And during that 5-year period, nothing has to come out.
It can, or, but it doesn't have to.
It can, right. You don't have to. But in the 5th year, by December 31st, it's got to be closed. We all thought the 10-year rule would work the same way. Yep. But no. The IRS said because of ALAR, A-L-A-R, at least as rapidly, we all been through this before, at least as rapidly, we want to, we're going to cry, not we want to, we are going to require required minimum distributions between years 1 and 9. So that's kind of what they said in 2020,
right,
which confused the hell out of people because nobody knew anything about this. So for 4 years, they kept delaying the requirement. They didn't really delay it. They still wanted you to do it.
Remove the penalty.
They just got rid of the penalty for not doing it, which in a roundabout way says, don't worry about it. You don't have to do it. And then I think it was in 2023, maybe 2024. Gosh, I can't remember when the quote unquote final interpretation of Secure 1, we're still waiting for the final interpretation of Secure 2, came out. And the IRS said, hey, here's what we're going to do. We're going to kind of keep this as simple as we can. If you inherit a traditional IRA from someone who died before their required beginning date, which is April 1st of the year following the year, they are first subject to required minimum distributions. Right now, that's age 73. So if somebody dies before April 1st of the year following the year they turn 73, you don't have to take anything out during the first 9 years, unless you want to, close that IRA fully in year 10. But if somebody died after April 1st of the year following the year they were subject to RMDs, then you must continue to take RMDs for year 1 through 9 based on your remaining life expectancy and fully close it in year 10. So Chat was correct in that first bullet point for traditional IRAs. Chris, you said it before. I'll let you talk now. Why was Chat wrong with Roth IRAs? Roth IRAs have a unique feature. They never have a what?
They never have a required beginning date. So since Congress, or since the IRS, when they clarified this rule, keyed in whether you have to take RMDs or not, keyed in on you reaching your required beginning date, that is what left Roth IRAs outside of the potential for having RMDs during the first 9 years. Because there is no required beginning date on a Roth. The original account, correct. The original account owner never will reach an age where they have an RMD. So they never will have been subject to RMDs prior to death. And the rule is, as written currently, is all about if the original account owner was subject to RMDs, you have to do RMDs. But if they weren't subject to RMDs, you do not have to do RMDs. You do have to just deal with the 10-year limitation. So Roths, since they clarified this, have been playing under the new rules. If you inherit one, and you're a non-spouse, first 9 years, you can, but don't have to take anything at all out. You just have to drain it by the end of the 10th year, and you'll have satisfied the requirement.
And it'll be 100% tax-free. So you're just going to let it sit inside the Roth and grow tax-free for another decade.
And hopefully grow. And that's that. The growth on that tax-free is probably going to catch the attention of Congress, and they're going to say, nah, that's, again, low-hanging fruit. Let's make them take it out like they do on a traditional, or let's, you know, reduce the 10 years, or who knows what they're going to do. But it is kind of a distinct advantage right now on a Roth IRA in being inherited by a non-spouse.
They're gonna force RMDs. Mark my words. I don't know when, but they will, because they can. They love it. That's the best thing Congress loves, getting tax revenue when they're not even raising taxes. And they're going to pawn it off by saying, it goes against the intent of IRAs. We're just equalizing Roths and traditional IRAs. We're still not taxing it. Oh, that sounds perfect. We're equalizing. It's only fair. And boom, what they're trying to do is get you to do something with the money you now took out tax-free so they can generate tax revenue. Anyways, that's my point. Let's continue. Chat then says, for owners who died before their required beginning date, the 10-year rule applies. But annual RMDs are not required. That's correct. We just said that. For traditional IRAs, Chat is giving an answer for traditional IRAs, but talking about Roth IRAs. The IRS waived penalties for missed RMDs for 2021 through 2024. But starting in 2025, annual RMDs will be enforceable. That's what we referenced. They waived the penalty if you quote unquote missed the RMD. They're not making you go back and take it. So Chad is correct there. But again, with traditional IRAs, your first RMD will be due by December 31st, 2024, based on the single life expectancy table, and the account must be fully distributed by December 31st, 2023. Now, that sentence kind of flies in the face of their previous sentence, that the penalty was waived for 21 through 24.
Right.
Here it's saying, well, no, it is correct. Chad is correct. But it should have said, but you don't have to take it in 2024 if you don't want to. But Chad is incorrect because it's applying that rule to a Roth. Chad should have said what Chris and I just said. Because there is no required beginning date for your Roth IRA you inherited, you do not have to take any RMDs for the first 9 years of the 10-year rule. You have to fully close that Roth IRA in year 10. That's what Chat should have said. But then Chat gave him the sources. Now, I did not go to the sources, but I can all but guarantee you the very first source did not get this wrong. I know just when I saw the name. Chat misinterpreted. Chat said he went to Kitsis.com, summary of the 10-year rules, Larson Brown Law Review article, an IRS penalty waiver notice. It may have gone to those three sources. I can guarantee you Kitsis was not wrong. Or Kitsis wouldn't still have it up there. So Chat simply misinterpreted IRA rules, which generally mean traditional IRAs, or even in writing, it'll be TIRA, all capital, telling you that's traditional IRA, to delineate from R. IRA, Roth IRA. Anyways, don't rely on everything Chat's telling you. It's correct if you were talking about a traditional IRA.
Yeah.
100% wrong if you're talking about Roth IRA. You do not have to take any money out for the first 9 years. If your dad sadly passed away in 2023, just again, imagine you standing on a rock that has 2023 printed on it and now take 10 steps out and see where that rock is, and that's when it has to be fully closed by December 31st. A lot of people get screwed up on how to count. So you go 2023, you're going to step off the first one, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33. By December 31st of 2033, close that Roth.
Yep.
Okay, that was the Roth one. Now let's go to...
We probably only have time for one more. Pick a good one.
Let's see. I got the Irma one. I'm trying to look through that one again. I have a feeling you could nail this Irma one really quickly, allowing us to do both. Let's go to the Irma one.
Okay.
Hi, Jim. Should be Chris. Chris does Irmas. Hi, Jim and Chris. I'll throw that in there. I recently started listening to the podcast and really enjoy what you, Jake, and Jacob are doing. I've learned a lot, especially about structuring the retirement plan for my wife and I. But my question today is about a situation for my mom. My dad passed away several years ago, and with his death, she lost their Social Security payments. She was a teacher and had a state pension, so she was ineligible until recently to receive her Social Security survivor benefits.
Right.
And what he's referencing is the Social Security Fairness Act for government employees and nobody else,
right,
who allows government employees now, nobody else, just government employees, to continue to receive a Social Security survivor benefit, even though their substitute for Social Security, their state pension in this case, continues
bigger
as well.
Yeah.
Everybody else is going to lose the smaller of the two.
Yep.
So anyways, he references that. That changed when the Social Security Fairness Act, and again, the correct name of that is for government employees and nobody else, was signed into law.
Yep.
She recently now received Social Security benefits. Amazing. Good for the government workers. Everybody else, screw
and
you.
And backdated, you know, she probably got a nice lump sum payment because it was made effective January 1st of 2024.
Is that going to impact Irma? He thinks it is because the get out of jail Irma card or form SS-44 doesn't have anything to say, hey, this was a one-time payment. So he's wondering, the issue now in 2027, her 2025 income for Irma purposes is going to be artificially high due to stacking this lump sum payment onto her 2025 income, which is now going to be Social Security, pension, and her RMDs. Mm-hmm. I know we can submit the IRS form for Irma consideration, but when I look at the form, none of the life-changing events seem to fit her situation. Do you have any thoughts on the proper way to approach this? Or is it just a one-year problem we're going to have to deal with?
Yeah, it's going to sound a little crass, but the bounty that you've received is what will pay for your Irma for this year. It's the same thing that happens to people when they sell a rental property or get a gambling winnings or something, you know, that is creates income for you unexpectedly. And the good news is SSA or Irma is a year-by-year determination. So if this bump up that happened shows up, then yes, 2 years hence, that income will be part of the consideration for Irma. Now, receiving it here in 2025, the Irma brackets will grow by 2027 when this is being applied, and that'll give you some relief. So it isn't based on the current Irma brackets. Everything is 2 years kind of backdated, effectively. The income from 2025 determines your 2027 Irma. And the 2027 Irma brackets will be set late in 2026, so we don't know what they are. But you're right. The form, the reasons that allow you to calculate Irma differently, and it even wouldn't really apply in this circumstance anyway, but the reasons don't include a sudden windfall of income in a year. Now, it's effectively, it's doubling up 24 and 25 into 1 year. And you might say, well, if they would have paid us the way they should have in 24 and 25, it would have been a little lower. It would be effectively half essentially for each year instead of all in this year. And that's true. That's true. And that if that bumps you into the next Irma bracket, hopefully it won't. Hopefully by the time the Irma brackets inflate by 2027, you'll find that that extra maybe doesn't put her into a really unattractive Irma bracket. I don't know the dollar amounts we're talking about and how close you are to the cutoffs, but it is a cliff. As you hit each one of the brackets, you go $1 into it and it triggers the next level of Irma. But you can see the 2025 Irma numbers for a single filer. It's at $106,000. Is the first trigger. So if you're 106 or below in your modified adjusted gross income for 2023, you don't pay Irma in 2025. By 2027, in 2 years, you know, that'll probably be $6,000 or $7,000 higher. So about 112 or so. So that'll provide a little relief. And then the top of that bracket, and the first bracket is not very punitive. It increases your Part B premium in 2025 by only $74 a month. You know, yes, it's another $1,000 for the year, but you got way more than that in a Social Security survivor benefit. You'll easily be able to afford it. That's my judgment, right? I don't know the whole circumstance you have. But the top of that bracket before you go to an Irma of 185, which is a pretty big jump from 74 a month to 185, is at $133,000. So that'll be over 140 probably by 2027 when this is going to actually be calculated for you. So there isn't any, SSA 44 is not going to help you. I think it's just a way to, you're just going to have to bite the bullet, or she will, for the year of 2027. And it is what it is. If there, since 2025 is not over yet, if there's anything you can consciously do to limit income. For instance, if she was taking other distributions out of accounts that were taxable, now that she's received this windfall, she won't have to take those distributions. So maybe her income won't increase. Now, if she's taking distributions due to RMDs, not because she just is taking it because she needs it, then the left hand isn't going to go down while the right hand goes up and offset. It's just, it is going to be extra money. So, but to the extent you can investigate and maybe find a way to reduce other income recognition this year, cap gains, interest, you know, things like that, you might be able to provide her for some relief, but there's not going to be a way to SSA 44 this because it's not one of the reasons that allows the recalculation.
Well, the other thing you can hang your hat on, perhaps, this isn't going to happen for 2 years, gives the government unions plenty of time to kowtow Congress to pass the Social Security Fairness Act for Government Employees and Nobody Else Part 2, saying, hey, that lump sum check we gave you and nobody else is not going to affect your IRMA. Okay, there's a little bit of, of anger there because I hate the fact of what Congress did. Because, again, I just look at regular people, the surviving spouse of my dad, who lost half their Social Security. They had equal Social Securities. Her pay got cut in half, and they were not wealthy to begin with. They lived in subsidized elderly housing, and she's suffering now. Mm-hmm. And that's just unfair that government employees who have some pensions worth $100,000. I'm not saying this one does.
Even if it was equal to the Social Security, it's not about the size. Let's say your dad and his wife had, you know, she instead had a teacher's pension. She would have been able to keep both, but she has Social Security instead. Say the teacher's pension was the same amount as her Social Security. So apples to apples. Now she gets to keep both if she had a teacher's pension, but because she has Social Security, she has to give up one, which you're in that circumstance was about half because each of them had about the same Social Security benefit. That's devastating to people that don't have a lot of other resources. But
absolutely. And that's why I said
that's the unfairness we're talking about.
Is applied it to everyone and means tested it. Because there are some people with government pensions worth 70, 100, 110, 150, a couple that we know 200 plus thousand. Why should they get to keep a spousal Social Security and someone in my dad's widow's situation loses half her income?
Yep.
I don't know. It just bothers me. Yep. Okay. Chris went a little long on that.
Yeah.
This one is an annuity question. Do you have time for it? It's not long, but it's up to you.
No, I think we've kind of pushed it to the limit for today.
Okay. Sorry. Well, we're going to have to, because we keep getting annuity questions and I don't get through them.
Well, we'll put them at the top next time.
I promise everyone we would do one a week. Yeah. So next week we'll try to do a couple of annuity questions, folks, because people have been sending them in. But we'll do that. Okay. Yeah. Chris went a little long on that, but that's okay. He normally does.
Yeah. Sorry about that. So once again, if you want to send in your own questions for the show, send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. Put it in the subject line. It's a question for the podcast and include a word or two about the topic. It's always helpful. We really appreciate everybody sending in those questions and you all continuing to listen to our answers. And I want to call out again to the listener who wrote in challenging one of my answers. And I appreciate that. A lot of what I've learned that I share with you all is from misunderstanding something originally and then learning the correct answer and then storing it. So to this day, I haven't learned everything and haven't, it didn't come to mind at the time to mention that that exception when I made that blanket statement. So kudos to the person who wrote in. If you feel that that's happened in other cases, I'd love to hear about it. And I'll admit if I'm wrong and look it up. So appreciate it, everybody. Take care, stay healthy, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.